Chapter 5, The G-Force Posse. When I was in 8th grade, I had this friend named Greg, and the way I met him was kind of strange. At the time, I had a habit of doodling on my desk in one of my classes when I was bored. I noticed that when I came back the next day, someone had changed the whole drawing around. After this happens a few times, I realized this person, whoever they were, became a pen pal of sorts, even though we had never met face to face. Finally, we end up meeting, we strike up a friendship because it turned out we had a lot in common, especially hip-hop music. Due in no small part to our friendship, I started delving deeper into the culture of rap, especially when we entered our freshman year of high school at Tarpon Springs. Up to that point, I only really listened to party rap. Rob Bass, DJ Z Rock, MC Hammer, NWA, Kid and Play, stuff like that. You have to understand, as a broke ninth grader, like so many of my peers, I relied heavily on my friends to introduce me to new music. Kids would make copies of their tapes and then pass them around class. This was the primary means for sharing music. One day, early in ninth grade, I'll never forget sitting in Spanish class with Greg when he introduces me to a group called Public Enemy. I felt like a whole new universe opened up to me when he showed me their jams, their world. I wanted to learn more, not just about PE, but all things hip-hop. This coincides with the first time my family subscribed to cable TV. Instantly, I felt like so many of my classmates, other teens whose lives had been shaped through their connection to pop culture, especially MTV. Immediately, out of my love for hip-hop, Yo MTV Raps becomes mandatory programming at my house. I watched the show every day. It was like a religion for me. This changed my world, as hip-hop was now used to be confined to my headphones and speakers, now it was in front of my face. Because of the visual element of the show, the culture became more real to me. Instead of just a mythical unicorn far away in another land, mostly New York City and LA, the world of my favorite artists felt somehow closer, more realistic. I became like a sponge. I was enrolled in Rap School 101, constantly yearning for more, determining to become a straight-A student. Greg dubbed Public Enemy's Yo Bum Rush the show, and it takes a nation of millions to hold us back from me. Looking back, these were seminal, foundational records in my career and in my foundation as a human being. I mean, these records were important. I bought into more than just the music, but I bought into the message. The irony of this should be a little obvious. Greg and I were white kids. Yet we were way more into hip-hop than probably any of the other kids in the classroom, even the black kids. And not just MC Hammer, but we're into militant black hip-hop. I remember one friend of mine I talked to hip-hop with, who was African-American, who was only into party pop artists, and I was struck by the fact that I identified more with groups like Public Enemy than he did, because they spoke directly to his experience way more than it spoke to mine. I actually found myself having to defend the ideology of PE and groups like that to him on more than one occasion. He thought I was a kook. Can you imagine? This should tell you how deeply the culture of hip-hop, the real-life story of rap, resonated with me. The moment it felt like Greg and I reached our apex of unity in regards to our hip-hop consciousness was when Public Enemy dropped Fear of a Black Planet. The year was 1990. The climate of the time, combined with the music and the message, just hooked me. That was when hip-hop became more than something I listened to. It became something that I lived. It was boiling over inside of me to the point where I had to participate in some way, shape, or fashion. Now, I'm super intimidated to become a rapper at the time, so I thought, well, being a DJ would be way more acceptable for a white guy. Soon, Greg and I were writing ridiculous raps in his bedroom. It became a means to project an alternate persona. We were embodying everything we wish we were, even if it wasn't a reality. The further we went, the more we experimented, the more we began to think that we should take it a little more seriously. There was another kid in our class that also tried his hand at rapping, and he quote-unquote released the demo tape. Notice the word released is in quotes, as if his effort was just a little truly less inspired. He had taken songs from popular artists and he had just put his own rhymes on top of pre-existing tracks. I should probably mention, he was white as well. We viewed him as illegitimate. So the actual impetus for starting our quote-unquote career was really just a reaction to this kid and his tape. We wanted to prove that we were the real deal and he wasn't. The funny thing about hip-hop is in a lot of ways it allows you to kind of speak things into existence before they're even a reality. Many of the rappers I looked up to rocked gold chains. They projected an image of affluence and success, and it didn't really matter whether it was true or not. It was a dream that you basically faked in hopes that someday you would make it for real. So we did the exact same thing. We became the G-Force Posse. G-Force Posse. Now, my friend's Greg's name, his nickname was Pigs, and my nickname was DJ Bones. Our crew was called the G-Force Posse based on an old cartoon that we grew up watching. As soon as we settled on the names, we began spreading that word to our friends. The response was not really an overwhelming support, as you can imagine. We became a bit of a joke, as most of our friends couldn't even believe they were taking this thing seriously. Every time we told someone about our group, they said, "You guys don't have a real rap group, that's impossible." But at the time, Greg had a friend that worked at one of the local music stores at the mall. Remember, this is the late 80s, early 90s, so the mall is everything. It's our hub, so to speak. It's where we bought music, it's where we saw movies, it was where we met our peers, where we hung out. It was the place where we tried to meet girls. Everybody hung out there. So when Greg convinced his friend to make a fake slot in the hip-hop section for our group, it was a big deal. Because we had no music to fill the slot on the shelf, it basically looked like the record was always sold out. Anytime someone called us out and didn't believe that we were legit, we would just respond with like, "Yo, check the shelf at the record store at the mall." And it worked. All we had to do was convince a few kids to visit the record store, and the word spread. We created a persona that was completely illegitimate, yet totally gaining traction with our peers. The next step in our career, if you call it that, it was a genius move, or at least we thought so at the time. It was actually an amazing scheme, and I can't even remember how we came up with it. We thought, let's charge money for our friends to be in the group. In exchange for a few dollars, we would give members a rap name and a membership card to be in the G-Force Posse. Obviously, I understand in hindsight that this is ridiculous. But in a strange way, we were actually inventing a crowdfunding campaign. Of course, crowdfunding in our current culture is the financing of creative endeavors through monetizing from your most vigilant supporters. You're basically exchanging music, merch, and the like for an investment on the front end of the endeavor. It's based on the close relationship you have with your most diehard supporters. So in 1989, we crowdfunded a non-existent rap group. Instead of investing the funds, though, that we had coerced all our friends from into the G-Force Posse, we took the cash and we used it to eat very well at pep rallies. We basically used it to purchase extra snacks at lunchtime. At some point, we thought, we should probably actually try and do this. That led to me going over to another friend's house, a guy by the name of Chris. He had a small recording set up along with a keyboard and a beat machine. We had written a couple raps and we headed over there one day unannounced and we banged on his bedroom window. He let us in, and we got to work. I have to remind you that I'm a freshman in high school at the time, meaning I'm in the middle of puberty, meaning my voice is constantly changing. So there I am trying to lay down some really dope rhymes, and my voice keeps cracking all over the place. I mean, I sounded terrible. Still, somehow we pushed through, and we finished our first recording. I'm sure if I could go back and listen to it now, it would be the worst thing I've ever heard in my life, but at the point, right then, it was the greatest thing I'd ever done. And one thing to note from this quote-unquote recording session was the fact that Chris's mom was in the house, and she's actually right next to the room while we're making music history. And at this point, before I become a Christian, I'm dropping F-bombs left and right at 100 decibels easily. At the time, I had nothing in my life influencing me to do anything different. But the funny thing about it, in looking back, I can clearly see that God was stirring in my heart, even as I was dropping R-rated rhymes. I remember Chris's mom pulled us aside as soon as we were finished recording. She'd heard me dropping cusses all through the door. She said, "Why don't you guys rap about something positive? You could even write Christian rap." I never forget when she hit me with this. I just shook my head and I thought, "Lady, what are you talking about?" I didn't even have a response. I didn't say anything to her face, but the idea to me was absurd. I was so angry because that flew in the face of everything I had convinced myself I was about. I remember letting loose a volley of profanity to Greg as we walked back to his house. I was defensive because even then, all back then, something spiritual was happening inside of me, even if I wasn't aware of it yet. It's amazing how the things we do in our childhood set the stage for our future and how seemingly insignificant decisions and relationships can come back around. Fast forward 20 years, Chris, without whom I never would have made that first recording, becomes one of the largest contributors to my first crowdfunded albums that I ever had after I left the major label system. To this day, he still stands as one of my largest financial supporters I've ever had. As it turns out, I was able to reconnect with him through my music career. I had the opportunity to set things right both with him and his mom for my angry outburst all those years prior. I apologized to them both, even if neither her nor his mom had heard the words I had said behind her back. The fact was, the words of his mom, even in the midst of my teenage rebellion, played a role in the person I later became. Amazingly enough, years later, I get the opportunity to speak at the exact same church his family had attended since back in the day when we made that tape. I was able to actually share this story about the principle of sowing seeds in the lives of others. You never know when your words will take root in the life of somebody else.